This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Undersea cables are important in our communication today. But who repairs them whenever they get damaged? Who'll be on board a ship whose mission is to help keep Africa connected? Also, recent reports say there's been an increase in crackdowns against the LGBTQ+ community in Tunisia.
Since September, the hate speech, the homophobia and the transphobia are largely spread on social media, especially across social media pages, somehow mobilizing or forming a public opinion to target queer people and also queer associations and organizations. I think it's gonna get worse and worse.
And why does West Africa have higher rates of kidney disease compared to elsewhere on the continent? It's Thursday, February 27th. First, we go to Ghana. A ship the size of a football field, crewed by more than 50 engineers and technicians, cruises the oceans around Africa to keep the continent online. It provides a vital service, repairing internet cables that lay deep under the sea. You may remember last year when millions from Lagos to Nairobi were plunged into digital darkness. That's after the cables were damaged, messaging apps crashed and banking transactions failed. It also left businesses and individuals struggling in the dark. It was the Leon Tevenin that fixed the multiple failures. A cable jointer from South Africa who has been working on the ship for more than a decade told the BBC, "Because of me, countries stay connected." Daniel Dadzi joined the crew off the coast of Ghana. He's been telling me how it all works.
So Charles, let's think about it this way. Let's say if you send a message on WhatsApp, you're sending a letter for the sake of arguments, right? You type your message, you hit send, and then it moves out. What happens is there are connections between your phone, which is usually via wireless, to a cell tower, if it's a cell phone. Now, that cell phone communicates with its cell tower. The communication basically then goes to a data center. A data center is a group of servers which exchange the information, right? They receive your information, then that data center or cell tower sends it to your destination, right? Now, most of the time, what happens is that the data centers for big websites like Google, like big apps like Facebook and WhatsApp, they are housed overseas. They are housed in places like Europe and North America. For Africa, most of the data centers that handle our traffic are in Europe. So what happens is that they have to travel along undersea cables to data centers in Europe before they are distributed to whichever destination they're going to, which in the example of a WhatsApp message is a person you're texting, right? And all of that happens in a matter of seconds because it travels literally via speed of light. What they send, the signals they send are pulses of light that travel along these cables undersea. So you'd notice that from the conversation that we're having, it's crucial and it's critical that these cables work because it's not just for WhatsApp messages or big websites. Most internet traffic, because there aren't a lot of data centers on the continent, most internet traffic travels on these cables.
Right. And in 2024, we had a case where those cables were disrupted. Could you tell us what led to that?
There were three major cable failures in 2024. In February, in the Red Sea, off the coast of West Africa in March, and off the coast of South Africa in May. We know that it's suspected that the February cuts that occurred in the Red Sea area were because of a ship's anchors. And that's basically dragged off. It was a sinking ship and it's dragged on the seabed until it was set to cut a cable Then, of course, in March, off the coast of West Africa, it was said to be as a result of a rock slide. The March cut off the coast of West Africa affected about 10 countries. And we are told that it was so extensive, the damage, because the cuts occurred in three separate places. And the thing about these cables is that when they serve a country, sometimes they serve the country in pairs. Some country have about four cables. Some countries, I mean, have about four cables serving that nation with the internet. But there are others who only have one cable. And as a result, when there's a major problem like this, the country can basically experience the equivalent of a blackout as far as internet is concerned. So this is what occurred on three separate occasions in the year 2024. There were major cable cuts, and in some cases, there were countries that did not have any access to the internet.
So Daniel, you went on board this Leon Thevenin ship, which repairs cables when there is a cut. Could you walk us through how the crew detects and fixes these damaged cables?
Well, Charles, it's a fascinating experience being on this ship. So the process, if I may simplify it, it begins with finding the exact position of the fault. Okay, so there are two ways to do that, and that depends on the type of fault that they have. If you look at the cable itself, what I said was that your data travels at the speed of light, because what is being sent are pulses of light. This is, of course, a very simplified way of thinking about this, but it helps us understand the process. Now, this data or your signal, it travels around along a fiberglass core. It's as thin as a human hair, in some cases even thinner, and it has just a small wrapping on it. Now, this is usually in pairs, and your typical cable would have multiples of two. So some would have two, some would have four, some would have six, and it goes on, right? Now, because you can't just have this fiberglass traveling for thousands of kilometers on the ocean floor, they are protected by layers of plastic, and then by what they call cable armor, which is copper and other materials. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that when they are finding where the fault is, it's easier if it's the fiberglass core that is broken. That's because what they do is when the signal hits the fault, it bounces back. And so they're able to determine where it's bouncing back from, and then they pinpoint the location quite simply. However, in the case of the fiberglass break, that can actually stop the cable from doing its work. Okay? The other type of fault they have is when it's the armor or the protection or the cladding around the fiberglass core that is broken or that has been exposed to the sea. In that case, the cable still works primarily. Unless it's very extreme, the cable still works, but the efficiency is lower. And it was a fault like that we were actually witnessing its repair.
Maybe it's the second guard.
So what they did was that they sent a signal from the land station, right? And they had a probe attached to the ship. And the ship traveled along the cable looking for the signal. And where it stopped detecting the signal, they surmised that, okay, so it's between point A and point B that we stopped detecting the signal. And so this is where it will be. It's quite a fascinating process. It's called electroding. Now, they're able to pinpoint where exactly they lost it because the cable itself is mapped and they have markers, if I can use that expression, they have markers along where the cable is traveling. So they know that, okay, so I lost the signal between this marker and this marker. Then they go further and do more electroding between the two markers. They try as much as possible to narrow it down to a couple of kilometers in some cases. And that's where they find where it is. The second thing that they do is that they send a remotely operated vehicle to inspect the cable, right? So what it does, first of all, is that it tries to figure out if there's any evidence of what caused the fault in the first place. Maybe there's a scar from a fishing trawler, or maybe there's a natural event like a rock slide, like what I was saying about the West Africa faults from March 2024. So that's one thing that the ROV would do. The other thing the ROV would do is that it will cut the cable so that it can retrieve one end of the cable, then narrow down the fault, make sure that is the fault on this, on the side that's leading towards the land. Then if it's not, they go to the other leg. Is the fault on the side that is going towards what they call the branching unit or towards the data center overseas? When they are able to narrow it down like that, then they cut the faulty section. Then they hand the process over to the cable jointers who work a bit like welders, if welders were joining hairthin fibers on a moving ship. They would do this, what they call splicing, where they would join new cabling into it. Then they will sort of rebuild an armor around it, then make sure that it works. Now, even the jointing process alone takes about 24 hours nonstop because it requires a lot of testing. At every process, they have to test it. At every stage, they have to test it. There are some stages that when they finish the testing, they have to leave the cable for the on-land team to test it. So when the splicing and all the testing is done, then they put it back on the ocean bed. And then most of the time, the closer the cable is to the shore, the more protection it requires. So you find that even the armoring is more. And so in those cases, the ROV would have to go back to the ocean floor and bury the cable. They will inspect it, map the new points, and then they'll bury the cable. So in a nutshell, that's how the repair is done.
Daniel Dadzi. There has been a crackdown against the LGBTQ plus community in Tunisia. That's according to Amnesty International. They say in the last few months, specifically between September 2024 and January of this year, authorities in the country have arrested dozens of people on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Also, the Tunisian NGO Damj Association for Justice and Equality say 84 people, mostly gay men and trans women, have been arrested in the cities of Tunis, Hammamet, Sousse and El Kef, and many of them are now facing arbitrary detention and unfair prosecution. In a moment, we'll hear from a journalist to give us the details. But first, I spoke with Wifarq Miri, a political activist and member of the LGBTQ plus community. She left Tunisia and moved to Sweden after she was arrested in May last year for her political activities. She says she also feared that her sexual orientation would be found out. She keeps in touch with the community back home. What's her view?
Since September, the hate speech, the homophobia and the transphobia are like largely spread on social media, especially across social media pages who are supporters for the president, Qais Saied. So I think it's somehow mobilizing or forming a public opinion to target queer people and also queer associations and organizations.
And what do you think is driving that online and media campaign that you say is targeted against the queer community in Tunisia?
I think it's under the populism propaganda of the regime, because demonizing and criminalizing civil society through the topic or the rights for LGBT people is unfortunately a subject that you can, through it, gain mass support. Basically, when LGBT people are targeted, only human rights organizations will speak about them. So it's a reason to say those associations and organizations are spreading indecency, are against the society. So it will affect their work and also it will put them in danger. I think what's happening now there in Tunisia, queer organizations are trying their best to give legal assistance and what they can do, but I think it's going to get worse and worse.
That's Wifarq Miri, political activist and member of the LGBTQ plus community from Tunisia. I've also been speaking to Elisia Volkman, who's a journalist and has worked in Tunisia. It goes back to the anti-sodomy law, Article 230. Let's listen.
Since the 2011 revolution, there have been a number of civil society organisations that have sprung up to support and advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. And they've always, you know, had to sort of dodge the bullets because, unfortunately, there is Article 230, which is the anti-sodomy law that was imposed under the French Protectorate. So they've been combating very serious and ingrained prejudice against the LGBTQ community, and that has been sort of part of the battle. But really, in the past 2 years, things have got much worse, and this isn't just for LGBTQ civil society organizations. All of civil society has been really repressed, and there have been a lot of very stringent measures, particularly about foreign funding, receiving money and donations from donors overseas.
So it's not just coming from the state or the laws, it's also just, you know, the general society. But in terms of that Article 230 that you talked about, this is an old colonial law, isn't it? Could you tell us a bit more about it?
Yes, it specifically, you know, it's referred to as the sort of Anti-Sodomy Act, but it's a law that's been used against all gay people, both male and female, and also trans people. The thing particularly about this law is that it's usually, particularly for men who are targeted by the police, the main evidence, unfortunately, is sort of an anal rectal examination, which of course is very invasive, humiliating, degrading, and painful. But this has been used in courts of law, that the police and the investigating judge will get medical professionals, legal doctors, as they're called here, to perform these tests. So it's, and of course it's based on a load of pseudoscience from the Victorian era and is a load of nonsense. There's no real genuine forensic evidence that they could use to prosecute people, except adhering to, you know, a load of old pseudoscience that is just part of the process of humiliating, degrading, and isolating gay, transsexual, you know, bisexual, and lesbian people.
Okay, so if somebody is arrested and charged under this Article 230, the anti-sodomy law, how are they treated and what happens? Do they get a fair trial?
No, there's no fair trial in these cases. Usually the arrests, they arise from sort of gossip or some kind of targeting or sort of hate campaign. And it's sort of opportunistic arrests. And unfortunately, what will happen is that once they're under arrest, and it's usually men or trans people who are arrested, they will be mentally and physically tortured, humiliated, and then the investigating judge has the authority to order an anal examination, which again is very humiliating and, you know, is tantamount really to a sexual assault.
And this hate campaign, you know, especially online that we are talking about, what do you think drives that, or who is behind these kind of attacks and campaigns?
This time it's very much people who are supporters of the president, you know, they're pro-Kais side. But in the past, this has been a mixture of just people from the right of centre, from sometimes in the past it's from police themselves who start targeting people. I've seen previous cases, you know, I mean, even years ago, going back, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, where a lot of sort of online hysteria could be whipped up. So it could just come from general members of the public, but certainly at the moment it's the pro-Kais side supporters, and you have this sort of call and response dynamic where you have his supporters saying sort of down with this sort of thing, somebody should be doing something about it, and then there is a reaction from the state that is responding to, you know, inverted commas, what the people want. And that legitimizes any actions of the state in the sort of new political dynamic. What is happening now, I would say, is an exacerbation of a situation that has persisted for a long time.
Right. It sounds like a very dire situation for the people there. But I'm wondering, is anyone putting pressure on the government to do something about this? Perhaps look at that law again, the Article 230, or just do something that, you know, is more progressive?
In the past, there have been campaigns to change the law or actually just get rid of Article 230, particularly sort of around 2017, 2018, when a number of laws were examined and we saw some progressive laws in, like the law to end violence against women. We saw in 2018 the first anti-racism law. But there was a lot of resistance to the repealing of Article 230, and a lot of the democratically elected deputies actually pushed back against this. Since then, different groups have adopted a policy that it's perhaps better just to focus on the health and well-being of members of the group and to offer more sort of practical care and support, particularly sort of psychological support, welfare support, because particularly trans people are very marginalized and they will find themselves, you know, forced into, you know, survival sex, into sex work in order just to survive. There were no MPs who were championing their case at all.
From what you are describing, it does sound like they have to live within a very limited space.
I think more and more the LGBT community really does live in a very small, it's a very small community, and they are having to support and turn to each other to get through. A lot of people who will identify as queer or gay, they end up living a double life. I mean, you have a situation where marriage is very, very important. The family is seen as the most important unit of society. So you will find that gay men and lesbian women will marry each other to basically quieten the parents and to, you know, reduce the pressure on them to conform. So there are a lot of people who are living kind of double lives, who are hiding. And certainly in the last few years, that has become more apparent and the community has become less visible. You know, in the democratic era, you would see, you know, gay and queer activists front and central in marches or on any social and political subject. But now people have retreated, and a lot of activists who are just exhausted have actually fled and sought asylum overseas.
And how many people do you think have left the country because they are simply not able to live within Tunisia?
I couldn't hazard a guess about how many in total. I personally know of a number of leading activists and, you know, people who are in a position to travel overseas. In some ways, it's a privilege to be able to travel overseas. And you have to remember that, you know, being queer cuts across all classes. So if you're from a more sort of working class or sort of rural background, that isn't an option. Certainly, I know at least about 10 activists over the past years who've left, and they've sought asylum, and people who are currently seeking asylum. So it's been ongoing for a number of years.
Elysia Volkman. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. 4 years, scientists wondered why conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and HIV led to more severe kidney damage in black individuals compared to their white counterparts. The answer, it turns out, lies deep in human ancestry. Recent research has uncovered a key genetic variation common in people of West African descent, one that originally evolved as a defense against sleeping sickness, a deadly parasitic disease. However, over time, newer versions of this gene emerged, bringing unintended consequences, a sharply increased risk of kidney disease. Despite the gene's origins in Africa, its role in kidney disease had not been fully explored on the continent until now. A recent study led by the H3 Africa Kidney Disease Research Network confirmed that West Africans carrying these variants are significantly more likely to develop kidney disease. To understand this link further, I spoke to one of the researchers, Dr. Samuel Ajayi, a consultant and nephrologist at the University of Ibadan Teaching Hospital.
We studied over 8,000 people, those who have kidney disease, about half, and those who don't have kidney disease, because to make comparisons. And we found out that 43% of the people that we studied had the only one gene. So that is only one half a gene, monoallelic. 29 or almost 30% of the population that we study in Ghana and Nigeria, almost 30% have the biallelic, G1, G2, or G1, G1, or G2, G2. When you have a combination of the G1, G2, the tendency or the risk of having kidney disease is higher. And also, we found that those who have only one harmful gene inherited, the risk of developing kidney disease is 18%. And there is a form of kidney disease where the kidney begins to get disease, we call it sclerosis, focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. The risk of developing that disease is 61%. So this variant of this kidney disease is also what we see in patients with HIV. So in other words, people who have HIV who also have these genes will have a faster deterioration of their kidney disease. So those who have the two genes, G1, G2, or G1, G1, we call it biallelic, the risk of developing kidney disease is 25%. And the risk of developing the glomerulosclerosis or kidney disease for patients who have kidney disease, FSGS, focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, is 84%. So this is the first time that you will have this kind of knowledge or science discovering why we are inherently predisposed to a faster deterioration of kidney disease, or indeed, why there is what we call excess body of kidney disease in African or West African population, as we might put it.
Besides the genetics that you've described for us, are there other factors that are driving kidney disease in West African countries?
Yes. We also have a high population of people with hypertension, untreated. Now, if we treat hypertension, we are not likely to run into trouble with kidneys. So hypertension is there. Diabetes is there. And we know with the rising change in lifestyle, many more people tend to develop diabetes. And in fact, diabetes is becoming an epidemic too. So we call them these two non-communicable diseases. So these are the big drivers for kidney disease in adult population. We also have elderly people, as people grow old, and men, of course, whose prostates become enlarged. They can have obstruction of urinary flow, and this back pressure affects the kidney. They can also damage the kidney. But having talked about the genetics of that, there is also something we call the second hit. Because the fact that somebody has inherited a gene for a disease doesn't mean it may automatically develop it. So in our environment, what we call the second hit. So in the environment that we have, whether it may just be about the diabetes or hypertension, when they have this together and they also have the genetic predisposition, the tendency or the risk becomes higher in them. So our environment also plays a factor. And there are so many things in the environment at the moment that can drive chronic kidney disease in the population.
Tell us how West African health systems are dealing with this problem of kidney disease.
Well, the economics, so you touched that the West African countries, the governments are struggling with tackling this. But what we are doing that we think will be more useful is prevention. And that is why the knowledge that there is something about this is important. And the add-on to this study is that at the moment, there is a clinical trial of a drug that is also being used to tackle this specific cause of kidney disease. So that is the second phase. We are also involved in that study, which you can actually use drug that will tackle this genetic cause of kidney disease. But for now, prevention is the best thing. If we control blood pressure, if we control diabetes, you know, we will cut down on the number of patients who have kidney disease, because these are the two main drivers at the moment.
So let me ask you this, just out of curiosity. For people that you said they have as high as over 60% risk of getting kidney disease because of the genetic variations that they have in their bodies, what can such a person do in terms of prevention to ensure that they don't develop a kidney disease?
If somebody may have this genetic problem, he may also have hypertension. He may also have diabetes. So if he can manage the diabetes very well, if we manage the hypertension very well, we may slow or postpone the development of this kidney disease, because we have not got to the stage in which we can do precision medicine and begin to screen people for this gene yet. We hope that we'll get there.
Thank you to Dr. Samuel Anjaye, a consultant and nephrologist at the University of Ibadan Teaching Hospital. Focus on Africa was put together by Nyasha Michelle, Stefania Okereke and Amy Leibovitz in London, and Blessing Adereba in Lagos. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge, and Gabriel O'Regan, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga. Thanks for listening.